On this week's 51%, we'll hear why pink-collar jobs have trouble attracting men, find out about baby cafes.
This baby cafe and the other baby cafes that will be opened will be breastfeeding-friendly community spaces.
And we bring you a listener essay. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Well, it's honey this and dear that all the time. That's not half as bad as all them lines. One of these days, her temper's gonna perk. If one more guy asks when she gets off work. Please tip your waitress, she's working hard for you.
Pink-collar jobs are defined as roles in the service industry, such as teaching, nursing, or waitressing. These jobs, most often filled by women, pay less than what men typically see for blue-collar jobs in manufacturing. But as blue-collar jobs are disappearing and pink-collar jobs are on the rise, men are not exactly bursting down the doors for the latter. To find out why, 51%'s Patrick Garrett spoke with Claire Kane Miller from the New York Times about her article on how men view jobs that are stereotypically seen as women's work.
So, Claire, if more men became nurses or took caregiving-type jobs in healthcare, took health aid jobs, would wages rise?
There is some evidence that wages would rise. Women's jobs, jobs that mostly women do that tend to be caregiving jobs, have always had lower status in our society. That is for a lot of reasons, but they've always been paid less. These are nursing jobs, preschool teaching jobs, elder care jobs, all those kind of caregiving jobs have always been paid less. But when men enter fields in which women have predominantly been working, it's a phenomenon called the glass escalator, where the men almost immediately get higher wages and more promotions than the women who had been doing the work. Now, that's not necessarily a good thing in terms of equal pay and gender equity, but in the long run, it could make these kind of jobs into higher status and higher paying jobs.
So when you have these caregiving roles that are often associated more with women and the way women have historically taken on these roles, do you think it's a more of a nature versus nurture kind of thing, that men are more conditioned to think that it is a woman's job?
It's hard to say if it's nature or nurture, but there is certainly something in our society that conditions men to think that they need to have jobs that are about being tough and that are about building things and that are about supporting a family, meaning making as much money as possible. Those are kind of stereotypes that boys and men are raised with, while women and girls are raised thinking they should be caring and empathetic. So it's unclear, you know, if this actually is about the way that men and women are, or how much of it is just society telling them to be that way. But a lot of the men I interviewed said the same thing, which is, I want to work with my hands and I want to build things. And they don't see health aid jobs and caregiving jobs as doing that.
In your article, you say if health aid jobs paid more and offered better benefits, they'd probably attract more men. Often government uses policies, as we see in everyday life, to help curb social change. Do you think it's up to the government to encourage this change, or is it more of a social thing that just will happen over time or should happen over time?
It's not for me to say whose responsibility it is. I think part of it is on the employers. So these are the fastest growing jobs, meaning employers cannot fill them more quickly enough. There's such a need for things like home health care aides and elder care workers, especially as the baby boomers get older. And so, you know, it might help employers to offer higher wages to make these better jobs. It would attract more men, but it would also attract more women. And I did a follow-up article to this looking at a linguistic analysis of job postings. And the job postings for jobs that predominantly women do historically, like nursing and health aides, they use a lot of words that have been statistically proven to attract women, like we need someone who is caring, things like that. Now, when people look at these job posting response rates, those kind of words attract women. Other words like, you know, world class and superstar, those attract men. And you're not seeing those words show up in these health aid jobs. So it might be, you know, one tactic could be for the employers to try to make their job postings more gender neutral, or, you know, to appeal to men in some way and to just make that a conscious decision in their hiring.
I find it incredibly interesting that employers would use certain phrases like this that are gender specific. I mean, most of the time when I see a job posting, it's often very neutral, but sometimes I'll see one that's like out of the park. They use those words like superstar. Do you think employers are trying to attract men, or maybe it's a psychological thing that's just built in that they see a man in this role?
My guess is that it's psychological. So the company that does these analyses of job postings is called Textio, and they do analyses for all kinds of jobs. And some of the words that they find that employers use for jobs that tend to attract more men are like world-class and rock star and manage it. And Textio, you know, then advises instead of world-class, say premier. Instead of rock star, say extraordinary. Instead of manage a fast-paced schedule, say handle a fast-paced schedule. The words that I just said as the substitutions are more gender neutral, they've found, meaning, you know, with their statistical analysis, they attract more equal numbers of men and women and a more diverse group. And I do think that is, you know, not that hiring managers are trying to attract more men or women, but it's almost just like a psychological thing. We were discussing before the stereotypes of what men and women do. Now, there have been some employers who have specifically tried to attract men to nursing jobs. Like, you know, there was one poster I saw that showed a rock climber, and it compared being an OR nurse to the adrenaline rush of you know, rock climbing. That is specifically trying to appeal to men and make it seem like a masculine job. You know, it depends what the goal is. It's certainly not getting the diverse, gender neutral response. That's specifically trying to appeal to men, but some healthcare organizations are trying that too.
In your article, you said that men are often used to working with their hands, that they don't see themselves in these type of roles, these often seen as stereotypical roles for women. Do you see this changing with youth, or is it a possibility that younger people are more open to the idea of taking on roles seen as for women?
So younger men in general definitely have less prescribed or traditional views of gender roles, and millennial men are likely to have a much higher expectation for equal roles at home and for, you know, women to work and for the men to help take care of the children alongside the women, you know, those kind of things. However, it really breaks down not just by age, but by education and income. So working class families tend to have more traditional views of gender roles than families that earn high incomes and in which people are highly educated. And a lot of the jobs that we're talking about, the jobs that are disappearing, like, you know, factory jobs, and the jobs that are growing, like health aid jobs, are working class jobs. So the gender roles might be changing more slowly in this case, even with age.
Now, often you see discussed online on internet forums, things like that. I know BuzzFeed's done an article, you know, websites like The Chive have done it. They've explained it as fragile masculinity. What's your take on fragile masculinity?
A lot of the social scientists that I talk to about this issue say that the stereotypes that we talked about for men, you know, having jobs in which they are tough and build things and in which they can support a family, those jobs are disappearing for especially less educated men. These are like the factory jobs and the manufacturing jobs that are disappearing. And what that leads to is a sense that they're not able to be a real man, that they're not able to live up to those goals that they were raised with for what a man is. And for obvious reasons, that would make someone feel very insecure if they felt they weren't able to be who they wanted to be. And a lot of social scientists point to this as one of the reasons that there's a lot of discontent, a lot of the discontent that swept Donald Trump to office, as well as why there's some resistance to taking these so-called pink-collar jobs, like in nursing, because they're not considered to be real men's jobs, and they're tied up in this notion that they should be something else. And you know, it's hard not to be sympathetic to that. It's very difficult if you can't fulfill the identity that you were hoping to fulfill. On the other hand, there's not a lot of signs that those kind of jobs and that kind of traditional masculinity is going to come back. Things seem to be moving in the opposite direction.
That was Claire Kane Miller, correspondent for the New York Times site for analysis of policy and economics, The Upshot. There are baby cafes across the U.S., and more will be opening. In fact, five are slated for a New York City suburb in Rockland County. Rockland was one of six New York recipients of a state grant to encourage breastfeeding, and the grant will help Rockland's first baby cafe to be up and running by the end of the year. The Rockland County Department of Health was the only such grant recipient in the Hudson Valley. County Executive Ed Day announced the $1.2 million grant at a WIC, or Women, Infants, and Children's Center in Spring Valley.
We're working with Baby Cafe USA, which is a nonprofit organization that helps coordinate a network of drop-in cafes where pregnant and breastfeeding mothers can get free support from trained staff and can share experiences with other moms. And that's critically important, as we all do know.
Spring Valley resident Jessica Tanisaka agrees.
Que es muy bueno porque hay información, o sea, las experiencias, se cuentan las experiencias.
She says it's beneficial for breastfeeding women to be together and share information, opinions, and experiences. The WIC Center in Spring Valley will house the first baby cafe in the Hudson Valley and New York City region, furnished with surplus from the shuttered Summit Park nursing home, like chairs, tables, and a couch. There are baby cafes elsewhere in New York and in Massachusetts, including in Springfield. Day says Rockland eventually will have five baby cafes, focusing on underserved communities in Ramapo and Clarkstown.
This is a good move for babies. It's a good move for moms. It's a great move for families. It's good for businesses, and it's just a great thing for Rockland County.
Melissa Jacobson is Assistant Director for Rockland County's Division of Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Prevention.
Here in Rockland County, we're really looking to establish these baby cafes in places where there's a lot of ethnic and cultural diversity and where the need is greater for people to come together.
Spring Valley resident Nan Kwan was on hand with her five-month-old son.
I love this office. They've helped me so much in learning how to breastfeed, and they've helped me to learn to be more comfortable with breastfeeding in public. It's kind of, not that it's looked down upon, but it's been looked at very differently. It felt like it wasn't normal, and they made me feel very comfortable. They empower me.
The Baby Cafe will be a drop-in center open to all Rockland residents. Ellie Chavez-Slomiak is a WIC peer counselor offering breastfeeding support.
This baby cafe and the other baby cafes that will be opened will be breastfeeding-friendly community spaces. So this is to make the community more breastfeeding-friendly. There's a component of the grant that will work with employers so that employers can be credentialed through the state as being breastfeeding-friendly. Doctors' offices also have a credentialing for being designated as breastfeeding-friendly.
Day wants to encourage businesses to make accommodations so that employees can continue to breastfeed once they return to the job market. Lori Messenger is with the Rockland County Health Department's Breastfeeding Support and Promotion Program and is a breastfeeding mother herself. She says the grant will help dilute the stigma of breastfeeding in public.
You still face a lot of barriers out in the community and challenges and strange stares once in a while. And, it is still happening. So we're hoping by educating everyone, getting practices to become breastfeeding friendly designated is going to help break those barriers, those stigmas that are out there.
Georgina Martinez knows the strange stares.
Muchas personas lo ven como...
She says many people see it as, why are you breastfeeding in public? Martinez says she doesn't understand why, because it's not something bad. It's natural. Again, Jacobson.
We're going to be working with private entities like work sites. We're hoping to approach some larger community venues in the county, like the mall, to have a lactation space designated there. So we're really hoping that it's going to be everywhere that people are, whether it's where they work, whether it's where they're receiving medical care, whether it's where they're shopping, whether they're praying, we're going to reach everyone.
Right. Agencies that will partner with Rockland's Department of Health include Nyack Hospital, Lower Hudson Valley Perinatal Network, and Child Care Resources of Rockland. Meanwhile, Day says the county wants to encourage its own employees to breastfeed and will create additional lactation rooms for them. Iranian-American writer Farouzi Duma, who lives in Germany, has written books like Funny in Farsi and It Ain't So Awful, Falafel. KALW Sandy Broy has more.
Farouzi Duma had almost come to India some 30 years ago.
My husband, when he was planning our honeymoon 30 years ago, wanted to come to India. And I said, no, I don't want to go to India. And so we ended up going to Paris.
Now she's finally made it.
I just want to take this opportunity to say that I was wrong. We should have come to India.
Except without her husband.
No, I came to India alone. Now, this is not my honeymoon, Sandeep, okay? I'm here for a literary fest.
This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata. Iranian-American writer Firuzeh Duma, who lives in Germany, has written books like Funny in Farsi and It Ain't So Awful Falafel. Her commentaries about her hyphenated life have aired on NPR.
Commentator Firuzeh Duma has her own story about food and the holidays. Here's her tale.
I'm 8 years old. It's the week before Christmas. I'm watching the Sonny and Cher Christmas special with my parents. There's no smell of nutmeg wafting through this house, and no gifts anywhere. Such is the life of a secular Muslim immigrant in this land, where Santa Claus visits a lot of people, but not us.
But that was a different America. While Firuzeh was in India, President Trump was signing executive orders, including one that bans travelers from 7 countries, one of which is Iran, the country where she was born.
You know, for the inauguration, I was actually in an airplane coming to India. I was in the sky. And I felt that was terribly symbolic because I was closer to God. I was above all of it. And it's been a really hard week for me. I'm a Middle Eastern immigrant. I love America. I'm an American. And I am heartbroken, absolutely heartbroken.
Luckily, she could do a little healing in Kolkata. She rode on trundling trams. She was stunned by how loud the birds were as dusk fell. It took a while to realize what a country of over 1 billion people can feel like. On the day she landed, she looked out of her hotel window and thought there was a parade.
A couple hours later, I looked out the window and it was still going on. And I realized it actually wasn't a parade. It was just people walking. But there were so many people.
And so much traffic.
It's a multi-sensory experience. And it's like LA traffic, but there's also goats and pedestrians all over the place, and cars come very close to one another. But the one thing that I don't sense here in the traffic is that road rage that I sense in California.
At a time when America seems to be putting walls up around itself to keep the other out, Firuzeh has been discovering the other, even though she had her misgivings about coming to India.
I have a really hard time seeing poverty, and I'm not somebody who can just go into my hotel and forget about something that I've seen. So I almost didn't think that I would be strong enough to come to a country like India. But I was very wrong.
But what amazed her were the conversations she had, especially with teenagers.
And they, you know, they're so capable. And I kept thinking to myself, you know, the future of India will be fine if these kids get to run the country.
The Kolkata literary meet broadened her horizons.
I keep meeting all these writers, and they represent a part of the world that I actually know very little about. So it's been very humbling to be here.
And the wining and dining at the literary festival has not hurt.
No, because, I mean, this is only for a few days. And in fact, no, I think it's great fun. I mean, writing is such an isolated job, and, you know, it's me looking at my computer screen in my pajamas and with a cup of tea in my hand. So the fact that I get to go to some palatial home and have a very lavish dinner with a whole bunch of beautiful people. No, I'm not complaining.
But not everything was eat, pray, love. She's been a dog person ever since the family adopted a skinny puppy during a vacation in Greece. Kolkata streets were full of too many emaciated strays.
So many of them are injured and they limp. And I saw one with a terrible open wound. And I literally cried when I saw that dog.
So on her last day, Firuzeh resolved to give something back to Kolkata. She decided her emergency stash of canned tuna and salami, which she'd brought all the way from Germany, would go to the dogs. Literally. She found a deserving dog for her Mother Teresa of the Canines Act.
I give him the tuna, and he doesn't touch it.
Then she found a brood of dogs with puppies and gave them the salami.
So they all came and they smelled it and they walked away. Well, the moral is Indian animals do not like German food.
But it ain't so awful. Next time, she could try a piece of falafel. That might work better to bridge the culture gap. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
And we have a President's Day theme of sorts in this essay from Deb Smith. She is professor of health services at SUNY Empire State College in Saratoga Springs, New York.
While cleaning out my mother's home in Troy, New York, I discovered plenty of surprises. Some of these came from my mom's older sister, Josephine Kennedy, who lived alone upstairs from 1958 until her death 35 years later. Then the apartment became mom's de facto storage unit. Like fossils beneath the crust of the earth, Aunt Josie's collected treasures remained. Inevitably, I found them. Josie collected statues of the Virgin Mary, from Lourdes to Our Lady of Sorrows to good old plastic Mary. There were hundreds of buttons. Matchbooks were crammed inside a vintage cookie jar, really a bonfire just waiting for the right spark. Over the years, the thing spread. The Virgin statues covered the parlor bookshelf, while buttons filled a large glass applesauce jar. Those matchbooks fueled a backyard bonfire once I got them. In Josie's collection of Kennedy memorabilia was a copy of the Warren Report and a UPI photo book called 4 Days on the assassination of our 35th president in Dallas. Headlines of the day JFK was shot, black typeface tall and bold enough to assault the senses, sprang from folded yellowed newspapers. Soon, a small white envelope with distinct black border caught my eye. It was addressed to Miss Josephine Kennedy in lovely, flowing handwriting. The name Jacqueline Kennedy appeared in the upper right corner in place of a postage stamp. The letter inside was signed by Jackie's social secretary, Letitia Baldridge. Something told me to keep this missive, even as I consigned the yellow newsprint to recycling. Recently, I went to the Historical Society in Troy, where Catherine Sheehan, the Rensselaer County historian, looked at our old house photos, the even older deed to my mom's place, and some other things I brought out of curiosity, like the Jackie Kennedy letter. It was fascinating, but when I pulled up the Kennedy letter, the interest level went up. Here was correspondence from the White House to my Aunt Josephine. Back at home, I examined the other items closely. There was a memorial announcement, the program for the JFK concert at the Diocesan Cathedral, postcards of the Kennedy compound homes and the JFK Memorial on Cape Cod, and a poem written by an American woman published by a local paper company. I found 3 JFK memorial cards, likely in the letter from Jackie's secretary. Another black-bordered envelope appeared, signed Ethel Kennedy in the upper right corner. It contained her brief note of gratitude, a biblical quote, and the memorial card for Robert Kennedy, who was assassinated during his own presidential bid several years after his brother John. Now I knew. Josie wrote letters of condolence to both Jacqueline Kennedy and Ethel Kennedy, and these were their replies. Once they were photographed, I'd donate them to the Historical Society for safekeeping, along with a photo of Josephine, the collection's owner. Visiting my mother in her nursing home, I mentioned the letters. Mom laughed at our Josie, who always did something outsized, ridiculous, or out of her station. Mom never understood why or what good ever came of it. I'd heard this song before. All her life, Josephine was portrayed to us as someone who didn't know her place. Just a file clerk with the state, Josie was a South Troy Irish woman who tried to reach people she could never meet and shouldn't disturb. Masters of minimalism, the Irish congratulate accomplishments with, "Well done." But the line, "Who do you think you are?" is a sharp-edged put-down, used in my aunt's lifetime. Growing up meant ignoring that question. Truth is, America's hope of a better world in the 1960s rested with the Kennedys. The Kennedys were also an objective measure of how far Irish Catholics had come in America, and an inspiration to my aunt who shared their name. With their collections, Josephine Kennedy silently answered the question, "Who do you think you are?" for herself. This time, far from a relentless, silly saver, Aunt Josie became the hero of this drama. She collected mementos of a day burned in history for the generations that followed. It was, as the Irish say, really well done.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1438.